Welcome to this week's Key Voices. My name's Adam Wainwright, and I'll be bringing you a roundup of the latest education news, as well as an interview with our special guest Chris Kirk, who is an education consultant and multi-academy trust expert. So in the news this week, the DfE has announced it will fully fund the pension contribution increase for the 2019-20 academic year. The pension grant for state-funded schools will cover the rise in employer contributions to teachers' pensions from this September. The DfE's free teacher recruitment service also launched this week. You can now advertise teacher vacancies for free on the government's new service by visiting teaching-vacancies.service.gov.uk. 60% of councils cut spending on pupil mental health, according to a study by England's Children's Commissioner. The research also found a growing postcode lottery of provision for low-level treatment, such as school nurses, counsellors, and drop-in centres. Also this week, the BBC has reported that families in affluent areas of England are much more likely to succeed in getting a school place on appeal. This is according to research by the Education Policy Institute. Paul Whiteman, the General Secretary of the National Association of Head Teachers, said there needed to be a more strategic approach to providing enough school places. Schools Week has reported on new statistics published by the DfE, which shows GCSE grades among looked-after pupils fell last year and absence rates rose. The average attainment aid score of pupils in care was 18.8 in 2018, which is down from 19.3 the year before. And finally, The Independent has reported that hundreds of children could be withdrawn from a Birmingham primary school that is facing daily protests from families who oppose LGBT plus lessons. This is the second school in the city to face demonstrations from parents who argue that their children are too young to learn about families with same-sex parents. That's it for the news, and now for our interview with Chris Kirk. This week, we are at the Schools and Academy Show 2019 in London, and we're very happy to be joined by Chris Kirk. Chris is a consultant who works with a lot of multi-academy trusts on everything from vision and strategy to their operational structure. So welcome to Chris.
Hi, Adam. Good afternoon. Great to be here at your stand in this great show that we've got going on.
Thank you very much. We're here to interview Chris, so I'm going to jump right in with the questions. Chris, you work with a lot of multi-academy trusts. What would you say is the most common issue that you've seen them face over the last couple of years?
I think the issue that comes up time and time again is just broadly in the category of growing pains. Multi-academy trusts, when you stop and think about it, are trying to do an incredible number of different things at once. First of all, they're still involved in the schools that have formed the trust. Secondly, they're trying to get arrangements for their own operations in terms of their head office. And often they're constantly also involved in discussions either with other academies or with the DfE about growth. I sometimes say it's a bit like being asked if you'll be a pilot and you say, yeah, sure, I might be able to do that. And then you're asked, well, do you mind if you actually build the plane while you're flying it? And that really seems to be the role that a lot of MAT CEOs have been thrown into.
Well, quite, yeah. Actually, on that point of growing pains, that very handily leads me on to my next question. You're right, the DfE haven't been too prescriptive about how MATs operate, but they're quite wary about prescribing what size a multi-academy trust should be. The research that's been done has suggested a couple of different numbers about the optimum size and viability of trusts. In your opinion, have you seen that there is a minimum viable size for a multi-academy trust to be able to operate and sustainably?
So the research, actually some really interesting research from BISA that came out, which confirms that the size trusts want to be is often a little bit bigger than they are now when you ask them what would perfect look like. My experience has been that chasing that particular rainbow, you know, really doesn't have an end. I've seen trusts get very, very large and still feel that things would be better if they were a bit bigger. I've also seen smallish trusts, 3 to 5 schools, who really thought about it, really thought about what they're doing, and they feel really happy at that size. So I actually think chasing a particular size is probably not the right thing. I think it's all about, what did we come here to do? How's that going to benefit students? How do we do it best? And if we can get that right, then in some ways we earn the right to grow. If we can't get that right, then being bigger and having the same problems is not going to do any justice to the children in those schools or indeed the staff working in them.
So in that sense, would you say that using growth as an answer to viability or financial trouble or sort of sustainability issues is not the right answer, because if you can't sustain at one size, moving up to the next bracket isn't going to help you?
Yeah, I mean, that is my personal view, which is not to say that a mat that has a clearer idea about growth may not get benefits from that. Clearly, with growth, you have the chance to develop teachers more deeply by getting subject communities together. You may have the chance to hire staff who are perhaps sort of further along their particular professional journey in areas like finance or HR. So it can be beneficial. But what worries me is when people leap to it as an answer to the current problems they've got, especially if the individual school budgets within the mat are not particularly viable yet. Once you add those together and add in some more who've got similar problems, you just end up with a bigger problem rather than a solution.
Okay, that's really interesting. Thank you. And I mean, we talk a lot about cost-saving measures that schools and trusts can try and do to help themselves sustain. Ultimately, though, I mean, mats can achieve economies of scale, but do you think there's going to be a breaking point where this just becomes an issue of education funding? Do you think we're there yet, or do you think there's still more that you've seen that trusts can do?
I do think we've got a real issue with education funding. There is not enough money per pupil going into the system. Now, you know, I've been around in the sector for long enough to remember, you know, sort of pre-New Labour government of 1997. Certainly, we had a lot less funding per pupil then than we do now. But what we also had then was local authorities. And now, in many ways, we don't have local authorities who are able to do the same things. So although the funding per pupil has gone up and is still higher than it was in, let's say, 2000, you have to look at the billions, literally billions of pounds that have been taken out of local authority support services, things like special educational needs, family support, all of which schools are expected to pick up. Also, the fact that local authorities used to have a fair amount of money that they were given in order to be able to run the schools that were in their authority. Multi-academy trusts can only have that money by taking it from the schools that they're running. So it's not a surprise to me that people are reaching difficulty. That said, there are many, many things that a multi-academy trust can do in order to become more efficient and effective.
So it comes back to that idea of building the plane while you're flying it. The local authority support that used to be there that isn't anymore means that now they're having to do that themselves. Do you have any examples sort of spring to mind of what you mentioned there about what trusts can do to achieve that financial sustainability?
Yes, I do. I mean, we, as you said at the start, work with a number of different multi-academy trusts within CJK Associates. We've probably worked with a dozen or so in the last 12 months. And then there are the many sort of inspirational CEOs I've met in the course of sort of running leadership programs with multi-academy trust CEOs as well. We've generally found that if we're thinking about the sort of trust head office area, there's a number of decisions a trust needs to make. Often what happens when schools come together and you get to around 3 to 5 schools is that the trust will hire in or second in somebody to the centre, perhaps to be a finance director, perhaps after a little while you hire in an HR director as well. And that's understandable because you want to get that central view of what's happening across the trusts. What trusts often don't do at that point is think carefully enough about what's actually still in the individual schools and who is still in the individual schools. And sometimes you find that staff in schools are being asked to do things that are really either duplicating or working alongside what's happening in the centre. Perhaps the head office will be setting some standards around things like finance, maybe getting a central finance system, but you still have lots of individuals in schools involved in actually making it happen. The difficult but important decision that the trust has to make is, if we were starting with a bit more of a blank sheet of paper, would we have set ourselves up like this? Or might we have more of a single way of thinking about finance or HR? Where we have worked with trusts who've gone down that path, typically we've found they probably save about 30% of their expenditure on finance, HR and technology. And hopefully mean that people have got a clearer and simpler view about the job that they're actually there to do, which can be fulfilling for individuals as well as important in terms of getting more money into teaching and learning.
Okay. And where do you think that stops becoming strictly an operational issue and maybe becomes a cultural issue for the trust, because, as you say, I mean, it's one thing to move a role centrally into the central team and away from maybe a school level operation, but then still see that people in the school are carrying out some of the associated tasks. But that, do you think it's not just that it's about moving the job centrally, but also the culture of that school having to no longer do that activity is actually, that's quite a hard learning experience for them. And SBM, who's been in that school for 10 years, maybe suddenly having to stop doing some of the things that they were responsible for, that's not just about sort of terms and conditions of role. Is that not a cultural element to their job?
Yeah, the cultural element is hugely important. I mean, schools are very much like families, and it's really important to work with everyone to find out what that future is. And I think the best way to do it is exactly that lots of people can get involved in thinking about how things should be done better and differently. Certainly, we would always work with the principals across each school, and ideally with their senior teams, as well as with people in the MAT sort of headquarters, to think about that future. Generally, I find that there are some areas that sort of schools are not at all reluctant to give up ownership of. If I listed sort of health and safety, sort of compliance checking, data protection officer, dealing with FOI requests, keeping websites and policies up to date. In my experience, these are things that schools are sort of always quite happy to have done somewhere else. I think the thornier area can be around finance. You know, very understandably, we've had 20 or more years of local management of schools, and head teachers have become very skilled at thinking about the business as well as the educational aspect of their school. Where MATs have decided that actually some of those business thinking, some of those financial thoughts, we're going to do in one place, and we're going to probably have schools start to re-specialise in education, there is a little bit of letting go. I haven't found that that's about a sort of a preciousness on behalf of school leaders. I think it's quite the opposite. I think it's more of a concern of, if I stop thinking about it, if I stop thinking about the fact that I know a number of members of staff are going to be going and I need to replace them, I need to think about how the budget's going to work for that, or how am I going to make the budget for this new technology that we want to use. Is somebody else going to do it, and will they do it as well as me, and will they know my school well enough to do it well? And I think those are serious challenges that need to be properly thought through when you're making the change, because otherwise things could go horribly wrong. And clearly what you want is to get to a really good place when those changes have been made.
Absolutely. And there are worse problems to have than school leaders who care too much about how things are run in their schools and don't necessarily want to give it up without knowing that it'll be in safe hands. Yeah. I think that possibly speaks. I think sometimes everyone in... when we talk about MATs, there's a temptation to be a bit over simplistic about the idea of centralizing things within a MAT versus leaving some of the autonomy with schools. And certainly one of the negative perceptions of multi-academy trusts is that schools can lose that sense of autonomy. But I think, is that not a bit of a sort of binary look at that issue, when in reality it's much more of a gray area? I mean, trusts aren't just going to either centralize everything or give complete autonomy to their schools. I mean, how do you see that as a balancing act? Because I don't think standardization across a trust or centralizing particular services is just one or the other.
Yeah, you're right. It is much more nuanced than that, you know, and you could list, you know, 50 or more different areas and say, how's that done? And even then it would probably be hard to say, is it central or is it local? Because within it, you're going to have a number of different ways of working. Whether you take something like, you know, finance, which you could split into a whole range of areas, from just auditing or complying with a budget to things like cash collection, or actually thinking strategically about how we're going to use this funding to get what we need for our students. And probably a sensible trust on any of those would have a good discussion about who's best placed to do that. I think what it comes down to me is the word subsidiarity, which doesn't mean doing everything at the most local level or at the highest level. It means doing everything at the level where you're best placed to make the decision. And I think if you hold that principle of, where are we best placed to make this decision, you won't go far wrong. And that can be informed by, you know, ultimately, who's really got the information needed to make this decision? who's going to carry the can if it goes wrong? So if the trust centralizes something and makes a decision, but actually it's still the head teacher held to account for that performance or that budget, that can be a real problem. So you have to think about how the accountability lines up with the decision being made. And I think, you know, Sensible Mats definitely do think along those lines and, you know, reach a good understanding. I think also when we think about autonomy for who? Because you could have a multi-academy trust that is all about creating, let's say, collaborative groups of teachers who are aligned around subjects and working across schools to get the very best English curriculum that they can. So that might have given more agency and, in a sense, autonomy to that group to think about that. It may feel to a principal in running a school that's within that, that maybe they don't have so much autonomy around that curriculum, because you could say it's being decided at a mat level. Actually, it's being decided at a practitioner level. So I think you're right. You have to look at the specifics of what's actually happening. I don't personally believe that head teacher autonomy in itself is the be all and end all of what makes things great. I think it's about the right group of people being given that responsibility and authority to make decisions, and that everyone should be having a say in how that's done. And that way you build those sort of collaborative groups that are really effective. Everyone's motivated, and you're going to get great sort of teamwork as a result of that.
Absolutely. And I get, and again, what you said before, if it's framed as reducing certain burdens and maybe checking compliance or websites up to date, the reviewing of policies, maybe not the most glamorous elements of the job and things that schools are quite happy to give up, then I guess that's where you've got quick wins over this is what the trust can help you with. Mm. Whereas, I think issues of the curriculum and maybe where there's a more obvious direct educational impact, I guess that's just more a more sensitive conversation to have, maybe. And that's where, would you say there's a greater value placed on how good your trust leadership is at communicating with head teachers? Mm. Is it a cultural thing as much as an operational thing, this idea of autonomy?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, thinking about the kind of workload that can be created. In 2000, 2001, we had this thing called the teacher workload crisis. And I was involved in a campaign called Save Our Sundays, which was really teachers, both primary and secondary teachers, looking at ways that they could get their Sundays back by not spending it planning, assessing, marking, and reporting to parents. Wind forward 18, 19 years, we're still having that workload crisis, and those are still the things that people are spending inordinate amounts of time on, despite the fact that there's quite a lot of evidence to show that not all of that activity is actually going to result in better student learning. So I think anything that can help people think intelligently about the best things to be doing, rather than just doing things because there's a form and I have to fill it in, is really going to help. And generally speaking, the more you can involve people who are actually at the sharp end of this, i.e. teachers and subject leaders and heads of department, heads of subject in those discussions, the better you'll have people working really effectively. And what the trust can do is put in place the systems that support that, so people aren't spending their time filling in sort of endless Excel sheets that they've had to make up, or exporting Excel sheets and merging them with other ones, because actually, you know, we are in the 21st century and there's quite a lot of technology that can actually do that. And you see some schools and multi-academy trusts that have really got that cracked. And you literally will talk to teachers who say, it's great, you know, I feel I've got my life back. They're not producing any less, they're not doing any less good for their students, but they're not involved in mundane things that weren't actually helping.
Thank you. You saved that at the end there. I had a worrying glimpse 18 more years into the future and there's still a teacher workload crisis, but that sounds like we're at least moving in the right direction, and hopefully it won't be another 19 years before it's cracked. Final question for you, and thank you again for joining us. And this is something we ask everyone. Given what we've been talking about, if you had one piece of advice for multi-academy trusts to act on, what would it be? And I will have to limit you to one.
My one would be belief. belief in yourselves as leaders, in your moral purpose, in your long professional journey through your career, to do the right thing. And, you know, 99.99% of leaders and multi-academy trusts, given that, will do the right thing. And I think time has shown that constantly changing and switching to try and keep up with the latest fad, be it from research or from government, doesn't usually have a long-term successful outcome. Some of the leaders and multi-academy trusts I admire most have had that real insight, they've had that belief, they've worked with others to build affiliation around that idea, and they have doggedly made sure that it happens and that it's happening day after day, not inflexibly, but with that core of steel around the passion and belief. So that's the one thing I would wish for them.
Okay, thank you. And we have that recorded now. So Matt Leaders, if you try that piece of advice and it doesn't work, you can get in touch with Chris directly, and he will offer you his sincere apologies as to why that hasn't made your trust successful. But it sounds like a good place to start. Thank you very much for listening. Key Voices is produced by The Key, giving education leaders the knowledge to act. And a special thanks to Chris Kirk. If you're interested in finding out more about our new support packages for Matt Leaders, available in September, visit thekeysupport.com/Matts. Members of The Key for School Leaders will find resources on Matt Leadership, Academy Conversion, and hundreds of other articles on the latest issues in education at thekeysupport.com.